Well, tonight we're going to study chapter 5 of Ecclesiastes, so it's great to see everyone, and we welcome everyone and those visiting with us. And tonight we are really into the heart of the book and into the section where he continues to make observations about the emptiness of life or certain aspects of it. But he's also giving insights and direction and wise counsel. And so watch for that as we get deeper into the book. So very good to be together. Ray Conies, can you lead us in a prayer as we start our study?
Let's pray. Heavenly Father, thank you so much for giving us our lives. Thank you for giving us direction in our lives, provided through your word. And thank you so much that things that are so difficult to understand in our life, when we seek you and search for you, you will give us answers, Father. Help us always have that mindset, and thank you for the examples that we have in one another. And help us all to be faithful to you, Father, because that's your design in your church. And bless Philip now as we go forward to this hour, and bless others who can't be with us. Help that to change, Lord, if they're able to come back and join together with classes as we are now. And thank you for the visitors that are among us who are not usually with us, and blessing them as they travel. All this we ask in your son's name.
Amen.
So, in a statement or so, what's the main message of Ecclesiastes so far?
All is vanity.
Fear God is where he's going to conclude. Yeah, we're headed in that direction. What'd you say, Rick?
All is vanity.
All is vanity. Vanity of vanities. All is vanity. What would you say would be the sub-messages of the book? Supporting that, under that, complementing that.
In spite of that, enjoy as much of life as you can.
We've seen that several times. And we'll see it again. It's like it keeps coming back to it. We'll see it again at the end of this chapter. It's another sub-message or sub-theme to it.
Living thing. Wisely as opposed to living as a fool.
Okay. Still there is a value of wisdom in living that way. And we're going to see he's wading into that in this part of the book. Yeah. What else stands out as a sub-message or sub-theme?
The credibility of the author.
Oh, yeah. He's a man who's thought this out. He's experienced life. He's got credibility. He's a person to listen to. Yeah. He's thought this through. Yeah, very much so. Well, what would you say would be the benefit of Ecclesiastes to an unbeliever?
Well, it points out the obvious.
Okay.
I mean, there's observations made that are clear to just about anybody.
Okay. Things that they can see are being pointed to, things that they can experience are being noted. Les?
The idea of that we're not crash test dummies down here, that there is, it may seem that way to people that are outside of Christ, that the world is just kind of this big experiment to see whether, you know, these humans are going to survive it or not. But that's not actually the way it is. It does seem that way sometimes. But the biggest point probably is that life is full of labor, and doesn't seem to have any meaning unless there is a God behind it all. And yeah. If there is, then it changes everything.
Yeah. It's almost like all this vanity and emptiness, it's like it's begging the question, is this all there is? Which then implies there could be something else. I don't, it's very few people, even the most unbelieving people, very few people would actually just come out and say, life has no meaning at all. Because really a lot of unbelieving people are trying to find meaning in life. It's meaning in this way and in that way and so forth. And this book is saying, there isn't meaning. It's almost like the unbeliever would say, well, yeah, I get that, and I've experienced that, but I don't want it to be that way. None of us wants it to be that way. And so for the unbeliever, this really stirs some things within them to say, okay, is there something more than just this vanity? Is there a God above all and so forth? And of course, what's the benefit to the believer? Uniquely to the believer, what's the benefit?
Go ahead. You can't enjoy life without God.
Okay. It's reminding us that we can still enjoy life in spite of the vanity of it, and we got to make sure that we have God in our lives, because that's where you find the joy. Yeah.
The stark contrast between life under the sun and life in Christ Jesus.
Right. Because if we don't have God, this is all we have. And aren't we grateful that we have more than just this? Yes. Yeah. One more, Andrew.
Just to add on to that, without that, between the wise men of this world and the fool of this world, the song makes it quite clear, your end's the same. You both get the same thing at the end.
Right, yeah. So there, when you look at it, life under the sun, everything comes to a point, no matter what route you took. Okay? Of course, then the question is, what about beyond that point? What happens? All right, so let's think about this. This would be a transition to chapter 5. Based on all that we've seen in Ecclesiastes so far, based on the fact that life is filled with meaninglessness and emptiness and vanity, what are some attitudes about God that can creep into our thinking? Because he's already mentioned God. Most notably there in chapter 3, verse 11, God made everything beautiful or appropriate in its time, and God's in control. He's veered toward that. Okay? As he's looking at life under the sun, he has veered toward this idea that there is a God, and he's actually in control, even though we can't really figure out all that he's doing. So when you are hit with this ton of bricks that the first three chapters hit you with, a few chapters, what are some attitudes about God that can creep in that aren't good?
That he is distant and uninvolved.
Distant and uninvolved, because look at all this vanity.
Even cruel.
He's what?
Even cruel.
Maybe even a little sadistic, and he's putting us through this for like the crash dummy thing. Yeah. It's easy to think that. Maybe doubt him in some ways about, you know, what he's really up to. If somebody doesn't explain themselves to you, you get sort of put out, suspicious, aggravated, those kinds of things. Of course, that's other people. And God is not other people. There's a big difference there. Well, let's look at chapter 5, because he is going to deal with God head on here for a few statements, and then get back to sort of some of the things that he's been working on. Rick, can you read chapter 5, verses 1 to 7 to start us with, please?
Guard your steps as you go to the house of God, and draw near to listen rather than to offer the sacrifice of fools, for they do not know they are doing evil. Do not be hasty in word or impulsive in thought to bring up a matter in the presence of God. For God is in heaven, and you are on the earth. Therefore, let your words be few. For the dream comes through much effort, and the voice of a fool through many words. When you make a vow to God, do not be late in paying, for he takes no delight in fools. Pay what you vow. It is better that you should not vow than that you should vow and not pay. Do not let your speech cause you to sin, and do not say in the presence of the messenger of God that it was a mistake. Why should God be angry on account of your voice and destroy the work of your hands? For in many dreams and in many words there is emptiness. Rather, fear God.
All right, thank you. You read New American?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. So, in discussing God as a subject, up to this point, God has sort of been a reference point, not a focal point. Now, this is a section where God's a focal point. And in approaching God, the wise preacher, true to his style, is very frank. He puts it very simply, very succinctly, and he has very stark statements like, you best not make a vow to God. Better not to make one and make one and not keep it. And just don't be rash with your words. He's very direct there. So look at the behavior that is depicted in verses 1 to 7, the behavior that he's warning against. It's the idea
that when you talk to God and when you make commitments to God, you're doing it very lightly. In other words, it's all about the talk, not the walk. It's shallow. Shallow in praise to God. Shallow in promising God. And it also puts it in historical context. When he talks about meeting God, what expression does he use in verse 1? You go where? The house of God, which is an Israelite expression. And of course, this was the meeting place, the temple, okay? God. And so as you're approaching worship and the different things that went on in the house of God, the animal sacrifices, the things the priest did, behalf of the people, all those kinds of things, then this is something you don't take lightly, okay? You got to think through what you're committing yourself to. You got to think through what you're doing, and there's got to be sincerity behind it, okay? So look at verse 2. This is one of those statements that really helps us regarding understanding the whole book, okay? Why is it? What's the one point he pauses to give reason? What's the one reason he gives here about why your talk should match your walk and you need to be sincere and serious in your commitments to God? What's he say in verse 2 about man and God?
He's in heaven, you're on earth.
He's in heaven, we're on earth. Okay, now, in this context, that tells us that he is one who is so far above us. This reminds us of what we've done this year in the Psalms. The Psalms remind us constantly of the high state, the exalted position of God, and how that we're nobody in front of him. And so this is a reminder of that. And so when it comes, you know, God's not someone that you can sweet talk. He's not someone that you can do, you know, you can snow. So he's not someone that you can take flippantly. This is as serious as it gets. This is the most serious thing that a human experiences. Okay? But I want you to also plug this into the book overall in those early chapters, in that here's a human trying to find the meaning of life. Everything is vain. There is no point. There is no substance. There's nothing lasting to anything he's experiencing. And by the time you get to chapter 3, he keeps talking about time. There's a time for this. There's a time for that. And of course, ultimately, who's in charge of all the time? God is. So, embracing the vanity of life and it not driving you crazy, you've got to embrace God with it. And one of the fundamental things we have to understand is that life may appear this way, it may appear that way, but the bottom line is we've got this tiny little perspective here on earth. God's way above us and sees everything. And this goes back to something we were looking at the other day. Where's that girl?
Well, another thing that verse 2 seems to be saying, too, is, you know, don't be impulsive in your thought to bring up a matter in the presence of God. Let your words be few. God's teaching us. We're not teaching him.
Right.
Don't tell God what's going on. Let you be quiet and let him tell you.
Yeah, I think about that. I mean, just extending that, too. He's really aggravated that he wants to understand the meaning of life. God doesn't owe that to us. He doesn't owe us any explanation. Matter of fact, he doesn't owe us anything. But he has abundantly given us things. And so, it's interesting, this book is more connected to Job, maybe than you realize, in that Job just struggled and wrestled and wrestled and argued and argued. But in the end, he just had to surrender that God's in heaven and he's on earth. Which is what this book is saying. You got to surrender, in spite of your frustrations with it, that God's in heaven and you're on earth. And, you know, he's just above and beyond. And so this is helping to sort of set the table for us a little bit. You know, he could have This book could be structured differently. It could start off with God is great and mighty, and he's done this and he's done that, and it, like all these proofs that God is to be trusted. Okay? And there's certain biblical books put together that way, like Exodus is. Exodus is put together that way. And God proves himself in Exodus. And then the rest of the story in that early period of the Israelites, okay, I proved myself in Egypt. Are you going to trust me? You don't have that kind of structure there. You've just got this harsh reality of the emptiness of life, and then you're trying to make sense of it, and then here are these little statements, these like echoes off in a distance. But God's there. But God controls time. But God's above all this. God's put eternity in your heart. All those kinds of things. Okay? So, and this is an interesting text. Talking about an unbeliever a while ago. This is an interesting text. Don't you think that one of the chief reasons... Well, let me ask you this question first. What's one of the chief criticisms that unbelievers have about religious people? Think about this text right here. This text. What?
They're hypocrites.
They don't mean what they say. They don't live by the words. They're big on talk. They're not much on walk. Of course, the next statement is then, well, why aren't you a Christian? Well, I don't want to be a hypocrite. Well, it's good not to be a hypocrite. Okay, that's a good starting point. But it's like this is the unbeliever's high road. Well, I don't want to be like those people who claim they follow God, but when you look at certain things in their life, they're not following God. They don't have a perfect track record. And it becomes like the unbeliever's high road that I'm actually better than you. You think you're so good, but you're really not that good, but I'm actually better than you because I'm not trying to be good. I know that sounds real confusing. But you get me? And I need to do that again. But I think there's something to that. But here's the problem with that mentality. There's a problem with being rash in your commitments and your words to God and not keeping them. There's also something really bad, and that is making no commitments to God. Not even trying. Not making an attempt at all, because then you're completely disconnected. And you're really in the same spot as this guy right here that he's warning about. It's better to commit and mean it. Okay? All right, verses 1 to 7. What observations do you have further about that, especially as it relates to what we've seen so far?
Well, I often go to Ecclesiastes 5 and verse 1 when I'm speaking to somebody about instrumental music. Because the first thing I ask him is, does it really matter to God how we worship him? Does he have any opinion about that? And this word passage starts off saying, yes. Be careful. Listen to what he has to say before you just start offering him anything. And I think it's got a parallel passage in Ephesians in the New Testament. So do not be foolish, but understand what the will of the Lord is.
Yeah, yeah. And I like that first verse is loaded there because you play it in the context of the book. He's been asking a lot of hard questions in this book. He is, what's stated and implied is that he's really demanding some answers. Be careful. When you really demand answers and explanations, we have to be careful. God's going to reveal what he's going to reveal. There's the limitation of revelation. Revelation always has limitations to it. God never tells us everything. Why? Verse 2. For God is in heaven and you're on earth. It's just the nature of the relationship. And so it's really a timely kind of, I guess you could say, balance here. Counterbalance to what he's been doing. It's almost like, because he's going to get back into this thing of injustice and money and not satisfying here in verse 8. It would almost appear that this is rejected in almost an awkward kind of way, but it's not. If you're heavy into saying, what's this life about? What's the point of it? What's going on? Ultimately, that's to God, right? Because he's the one that put us here. He's the one that organized life. He's the one that pushed the button and set it all in motion. Ultimately, be careful. This is all being let God see. What's the point of it all? Well, very first thing, guard your steps. When you approach God, you go to the house of God, draw near to listen. It's better to offer the sacrifice, okay, those kinds of things. Listening to God, considering Him, it's a good time for this reminder.
Well, I was just thinking about, because I do think in the Psalms, there is where the psalmist is pouring down his feelings to God and questioning, and God, I think God wants that. I think we saw that. But then I think back about Job, who was, you know, whose wife saying, curse God and die, but he was very careful, even though he was wanting answers, but he was still understanding who God was. And I think you see a carefulness in Job.
Yeah, will somebody please draw the line for me on pouring out our souls to God, like you see in the Psalms, but not crossing the line and losing our trust and our respect, our reverence for God, and straying from our place. Because, I mean, we saw that in the Psalms this year, that He wants us to express our hearts.
Well, you see that in Job. He almost seems like he crosses the line a couple of times.
Maybe, yeah.
Or it's really close to us. The Lord is really saying to him at the end of the book, who are you?
Yeah. We know three guys for sure who crossed the line.
Yeah.
Okay? And Job is dancing around it, okay? Okay, but there is this, when you take the whole of the book, like Lord's right, take the whole of the book, Job is honored because mostly he maintains his place. Mostly. Okay. He has to be rebuked. But in the end, look how he blessed and those kinds of things. He kept his faith. And of course, the New Testament commends him for his perseverance.
So, and I've said before, faith and perfection are two different things.
Two different things. Right.
I have to remember that our pouring our hearts out to God, He doesn't need to hear it. He knows it.
Sure.
We need to hear it. And by if we lose place of where we are and where He is, then we cross the line. Mm-hmm. If we are saying what we need to say and what we need to hear to remind us of our place and to remind us of our purpose and remind us of promises and the gifts and the wonders that He's made available to us, then we answer a lot of questions for ourselves. Because of His Word and the application of His Word and remembering where we are.
Yeah, and David is a great example of honesty with God, but a continual reverence and submission and recognition that He is the Lord. And David, I think, strikes that balance really well.
Maybe verse 1 and 2, it does remind me of what Jesus was talking about, the Pharisee and the tax collector, when they go up God, and the one bragging on himself, and then the other one standing somewhere. When you look up to the heavens, and meaning is just be merciful to me, a sinner, recognizing his place. That kind of reminds me of him.
Yes, that's a nice cross reference. It really is. Yeah.
It does seem like there's a balance, because I was sitting here thinking, well, what's the balance between chapter 5, verse 1 and the New Testament prayer without ceasing, and some of the things remind me of Paul when he says he treated the Lord about a thorn in the flesh, and God comes back and says, "My grace is sufficient for you." And that sounds like a nice way of saying, "Stop asking about this," So there does seem to be a balance between. Like we talked about pouring your heart out to God, but at the same time, it's, don't lose sight of who God is and who we are, and that sometimes we need to live with things the way they are.
And I think these comments are really good, and this is what I would say in a lot of these things. We pour our heart out to God, but not to a companion. Not to another who is another like us. we're always pouring out our heart onto the foot of the throne. It's the throne before the throne that we lay it before his throne. I may pour out my heart to Frank, okay? But that's different. He's another human being. And even though he's older and wiser and I would respect his view of things, he's just another human being. It's different when I approach the throne of God. And I think that's something to remember too. Yeah, one more and we'll move on.
Kind of reminds me of the person of the tax collector.
Yeah, that's what Vince was saying, yeah. Yeah, and it actually describes went up the temple to pray. Yeah, really did. It's very much like that. Look at chapter 5, verses 8 and 9. Verse 8 and 9. Zachary, read those two verses, please.
When you see in a province the oppression of the poor and the violation of justice and righteousness, do not be amazed at the matter. For the high official is watched by a higher, and there are yet higher ones over them. But this is gained for a land in every way, a king committed to cultivated fields.
All right, thank you. Once again, the subject of justice comes up, specifically injustice. And what's the nature of the social / government arrangement that is pressing down on someone? How is it depicted in verse 8?
Hierarchy.
And hierarchy, levels, a strata of authority. Okay? So there's oppression of the poor and violation of justice and righteousness. Don't be amazed at the matter, because that official is being watched by another, who's being overseen by another. Okay? So this is what you could call institutional or even bureaucratic injustice. So why does this kind of system lead to injustice? He's talked about justice before, but here this is a specific manifestation of it.
Human corruption.
Do what?
Human corruption.
Yeah, it's just because humans are running these systems. Yeah. And what about this structure of this official, this official, this official, this official? What happens in those situations?
The higher officials aren't directly connected to the lowest people. And so they don't. It's easy for them to not see them as people anymore.
To disconnect. So you've got this weight bearing down on someone at the bottom, but the person at the bottom is not seen, not heard, and so forth. Okay? And it's also frustrating, because what about this person down here regarding recourse?
Power.
The what?
They don't have much power.
They don't have much power or recourse. So they complain to the official above them, but what does that official say? It's out of my hands. So-and-so is controlling that. And then that person complained to him. Okay, it's like the phone call. You need to call customer service, and they keep handing you off to someone else kind of thing. That's just how that kind of thing is stacked up. It's almost predatory in that the system sort of chews up the people at the bottom a little bit, and it's so very impersonal. It easily happens in a way. And I think the big broad lesson from this is that, especially fitting in with the book, this is another aspect of the vanity of life. Look what he says in verse 8 there. When this is happening, he says, don't be what? Don't be amazed, don't be shocked. Don't expect too much from human systems. Let's have a couple of classes go ahead and comment about this, about the search for utopian arrangements. And humans have been looking for, whether it's an economic arrangement, a political arrangement, a social arrangement, or a combination of any of those, for a utopia. It's not going to happen. I would rather live in a democracy than any other system that I know about. That's my personal opinion. I would rather live in a democracy. But we have to understand that democracies are human systems. That were designed by humans, they're created by humans, they're planned by humans, they're carried out by humans. And so in the end, it all comes to this point. No matter what kind of system you live in, it comes down to this point that is, they're human systems and they're flawed. And these kinds of things are going to happen. And that's why we need the one great King of Kings. Is that fair?
This is what God warns them about to begin with in Judges. When they start asking for a king, he's like, you don't want a king. He, at that time, because he was taking care of them. He looked out for everybody. And he told them that this is what's going to happen. But you asked for it, so okay.
Yeah, there's a tinge of that. You're exactly right. You think this is going to be such a great setup. Here's what's going to happen. And it happened. Yeah, that's a good biblical model of that. It really is. Look at verses 10 to 17. It says a lot about here. He really builds on this from what he said earlier. 10 to 17. Earl, can you read those verses, please?
He who loves money will not be satisfied with money, nor he who loves abundance with its income. This too is vanity. When good things increase, those who consume them increase. So what is the advantage to their owners except to look on? The sleep of the working man is pleasant, whether he eats little or much, but the full stomach of the rich man does not allow him to sleep. There is a grievous envy, evil, which I have seen under the sun, riches being hoarded by their owner to his hurt. When those riches were lost through a bad investment, and he had fathered a son, then there was nothing to support him. As he had come naked from his mother's womb, so he will return as he came. He will take nothing from the fruit of his labor that he can carry in his hand. And this also is a grievous evil. Exactly as a man is born, thus he will die. So what is the advantage to him who toils for the wind? Throughout his life he also eats in darkness with great vexation, sickness, and anger.
All right, thank you. So Jesus is depicting the drawbacks of pursuing wealth for fulfillment. That's the first time he's talked about this topic in the book. He comes back to it again and gives us more about it. I would have you see there are three aspects to the drawbacks. Okay? First of all, verse 10, what's the drawback? Okay? It will never fulfill you. No matter how, if you crave money and wealth, no matter how much you have, it's never going to fulfill you. And again, we ought to come back to that sort of stake in the ground statement back in chapter 3, verse 11. Why is it that wealth doesn't satisfy us? In light of 3:11. Eternity is bound up in the heart of man, and wealth, along with all kinds of other things here under the sun, is not eternal. It's just not. Okay? According to verse 11, what's another drawback to wealth?
As you make more, your expenses are coming up with it. Look at Solomon. He had all this stuff, and he just had to hire more and more and more people to keep up with everything.
So that's the general principle, that the more you acquire, the more it takes to manage it. Okay? And specifically in verse 11, what particular aspect increases your overhead?
Your popularity.
Yeah.
Yeah. You get more people around you who consume.
Parasites. It's like a parasite attaches itself to a living creature and sucks the blood. It's the entourage that gathers around the person. Takes more and more people to do that. You got to have a driver because you're in the back of the car having to call people all the time. Well, then you get so much money, you got to have a little security. So you got to have a guy following your car. I mean, it just keeps going and going and going and going and going. Okay, and really, when you begin to calculate, you're not earning and you're not acquiring even as much as you think you are. Because you've got so much going out the back door that what's coming in the front door is not as much as you think is coming in. And then verse 12 describes what? What's the drawback?
You're not working as hard. You don't sleep as good.
Okay. So the man who is working, just a common worker, and he's got just a common meal, he works hard, he gets a reasonable meal in his stomach, and he sleeps really well. But the rich guy, what's his problem? He's got a full stomach, okay? So this is very unusual. We hit this tipping point probably 75 years ago, would be a guess. Up to that point in human existence, being overweight was a sign of wealth. And actually, people were painted heavier than sometimes they really were on purpose. There's some early paintings of George Washington with a little stomach. He didn't have a stomach. He had a great core, George Washington. He was really in great shape. But he was painted that way on purpose because the wealthy upper class people were portrayed that way. Why? Because most of them were. And so this is falling in that category. And so somebody with wealth has all the food they can eat, and they fill themselves up, and you get indigestion. You get stomach problems. The tipping point now is that food is so abundant, and prepackaged food and so forth goes to the lower income people and all that kind of thing. It's a weird kind of flip. But understand this time that having a full stomach was reflective of wealth. But there was a drawback to that. And that is, if you eat a lot of rich food, boy, what a day, what a time to be making this point. Like, to see how many people got that, just want to ripple through. But we're not talking about, you know, an occasional celebration of feast. We're talking about every day, you know. And you read in the Old Testament about what Solomon had at his table every day. But guess what? He had a bunch of people there eating it too. But still, that's the picture. And so abundance creates this restlessness. You can't sleep well, okay, because of that. And then there's this case study starting in verse 13, this person. This person actually acquires riches, okay? But according to verse 13, what happens?
He hoards it.
Okay? To his own hurt, okay? And he keeps it to his own hurt, okay? So he's like he's hoarding it. And then in verse 14, what happens?
He lost it through a bad investment.
That's right. He loses it through some kind of bad venture. So he acquires riches, and he's covetous of that. And then he loses it. Okay? It's like double pain. You get it, and then you lose it. Okay? And in the end, he doesn't even have enough for what? Verse 14. In verse 14.
Son.
For his own son. So here's this wealthy guy who's acquiring these riches. And you know what he thinks he's going to do? He's going to, you know, leave it to his children and all that kind of stuff. And he loses it, and he has nothing to leave. Okay? And how does he end up, according to verse 15 and 16? All this work, all this anxiety, all this effort, but he ends up how?
Same way he came in.
Same way he came in. Empty hand. Same way. I mean, it's like, see the vanity of that? He doesn't say vanity here in those lines, but he's depicting vanity. You acquired all that wealth, then you lost it. And you're going to leave this life just like you came in, okay? And actually, what's the thing in verse 17? What's the real enduring thing he got out of this experience?
Sorrow, sickness, and anger.
Vexation, sickness, and anger. It's just all that stress, all that anxiety of acquiring the wealth, trying to hold the wealth, and then losing the wealth. What did it do for him? It gave him vexation, sickness, and anger. That's a sad picture right there.
If I had to hang on to it, it's almost as hard as
it. There you go. It's greasy, isn't it? Yeah.
So. The opposite of his earlier counsel. It's best for man to eat, drink, Joy.
Right. And there's the time for that. That's what he does next. Exactly right. Let's look at that. 18 to 20. 18 to 20. Les, will you read those verses?
Here is what I have seen. It is good and fitting for one to eat and drink and to enjoy the good of all his labor in which he toils under the sun all the days of his life, which God gives him, for it is his heritage. As for every man to whom God has given riches and wealth and given him power to eat of it, to receive his heritage and rejoice in his labor, this is the gift of God. For he will not dwell unduly on the days of his life, because God keeps him busy with the joys of his heart.
All right, here's the contrast. Contrast, look closely here. Evidently, there are things to use and have and possess, but three times, how are these things depicted? In verse 18, at the end of that verse, at the beginning of verse 19, and the end of verse 19. Gift of God.
Reward.
A what?
Reward.
Right. Blessing, a benefit from the Lord. And that's your reward, okay? Now, contrast that with the guy we just read about, verses 10 to 17. What's the contrast between the person being how he wants us to be in verses 18 to 20 and the man he depicts in verse 13 to 17? What's the contrast?
Empty and full.
All right. Empty and full. The guy with all the money that loses it ends up empty. This person ends up satisfied, and it doesn't really say how much he had. What else is contrast?
I'm reminded of that story you said told about that miser woman.
Quote about the miser woman?
The lady that, you know, would be worth nowadays the equivalent of like $10 billion but died because she couldn't find free health care. That was just like,
I don't think I remember saying that, but that sounds interesting. Yeah. So if somebody can help me with that. It sounds like an interesting story. But this person is satisfied, but there's no indication they're wealthy. Yeah.
Well, you asked for contrast.
Yes.
The person in verse 10 through 17 loves money and pursues it. This person is satisfied with what they have.
It's the focus on the acquisition and the possession and the love of that and the greed of that. It's back to verse 10, he who loves money will not be satisfied. This person is enjoying what they have, but their pursuit is not the stuff. Their pursuit is the giver, not the gift. Okay? And he even makes, what does he say about the length of this man's life in verse 18 to 14? Yeah, just days. Even some say, you know, some translations say his few days or short days, like that. And so what this is telling us is that in the midst of the vanity of life, which includes the vanity, the emptiness of our physical possessions, there is still yet a way to enjoy your physical possessions. And the way you do that is you see it not as a personal gain, acquisition, accomplishment, which is what's depicted earlier in the book, like chapter 2, but rather, it's a gift from God. That what I have is a gift from God. And that's where you enjoy it. And look what he's doing here, and he's done it already several times, as Ray said. He's actually commanding us, he's advising us to enjoy what we have. How do we usually view joy? He's telling us to enjoy what we have, okay? How do most people usually think of joy? How does joy come?
Peace and contentment.
Yeah, it's associated with peace and contentment. Yeah, how do you get joy, according to a lot of people?
I receive.
It's what?
More stuff.
Stuff? Yeah. Circumstances? You know, have you had a good day? Well, so the good day is completely, in a lot of people's mind, dependent upon the events of that day. It's all exterior. Okay? It's all on the outside. When we're told to enjoy things or to rejoice, that means we have a choice in it. and maybe we can explore this more, but this is actually telling us that joy is a choice. Joy is a choice. And here he's talking about the choice to enjoy what we physically have. And it all has to do with the idea of focusing on it being a gift of God, not a personal accomplishment. Okay, thank you very much.